Well, here we are on Labor Day weekend, and unfortunately, my baby girl's first day of kindergarten is indefinitely delayed. But meanwhile, colleges are starting, universities are starting. I know a lot of our young adults are heading off or have already headed off to start university for the first time for many of them this week. And I've had conversations over the summer, over the last while, with many young adults who are trying to figure out what they should be doing, what they should pursue, what school they should go to, what job to get, all those kind of big questions that you ask at that age. Now, for me, it was really easy because I knew from when I was just a child what God had called me to do. I knew he was calling me to be a pastor and to teach the Bible from like when I was like a kid, just like 10 years old. And it was something I just knew deep in my gut that this is what God had called me to it. This is something I had to do. But it's not like that for most people. It's, you know, everyone's different. I know for Tyler, he would say that he didn't feel called to be a youth pastor till he was well into college. And so it was much later that he went, oh, okay, this is what God's calling me to, and sensing that sort of gut calling to ministry as a pastor. You know, and then a while ago, I was talking with a young man who was trying to discern whether he was called to be a pastor. And he's wondering, is this something I should do or maybe not? You know, I'm not sure. And I gave him a book to read, and I prayed for him, and we discussed it, and we got together. And you know, he said to me, as he had thought about it and thought about the things I had said to him, he said, you know, the way you talk about being called to being a pastor is the way that I feel about being a teacher. And so there, it was really clarifying him that he wasn't called to be a pastor, but he was called to something else. So there was a calling that he sensed as he thought about it, prayed about it, worked through it, but it was to a different vocation. But we don't often hear people talk like that. God calls people to be pastors, to be missionaries, and then what? Does he just leave the rest of the people just kind of figure it out? He calls some and everyone else just sort it out, find something to do, will you? You need money, sort it out. Does he call someone to be a politician? Does he call someone to be a teacher, to start a business? Does God care about other kinds of work, or does he just care about church work? You know, for many Christians, we view God's work as church ministry, missionary work, spreading the gospel, and certainly those things are God's work. We talk about a pastor, we say something like he's serving the Lord in ministry rather than doing secular work. You know, sometimes I'll have a conversation about the Sabbath, keeping Sabbath and rest, and whether it's appropriate to work on Sunday, this conversation. And I'll point out, you know, as a pastor, I work on Sundays, so certainly there's exceptions. And they'll say, people will correct me. Well, that's different because you're doing God's work, so that doesn't count as, you know, working on Sunday. So there's this view of God's work as church work and all other work is something else. We're not really sure what. So often we consider it, this is the way we divide it in our minds, and maybe you've done this as well. So what does God think about our non-church work? How do we do our job as a Christian? And there's a number of ways people have thought about this. Here's some of them. You know, maybe there's nothing inherently good about my work in and of itself. But as a Christian, I try to bring my Christian morality to it. You know, honesty, integrity, truthfulness, even if it costs me some business or costs me some clients or whatever it may be. I'm going to bring my Christian morality to bear on my work. So that's one way that people have thought Christianly about work. Or maybe it's something like this. How I work as a Christian is that I use my workplace, my relationships at work, the opportunities through work to present the gospel to people. God has placed me in this job in a network for evangelism, to spreading the gospel. So I can do God's work at my work. You know what I'm saying there? Or people have thought about it this way. Maybe work is just a necessary evil, right? The value of work is not in the work itself, but in the result of that work, making money. And a Christian works hard, does well to make money in order to provide for family members, which is honorable, to give to the poor, obviously honorable, and to help fund church ministry, missionary work. So to work Christianly is to make a lot of money and use it and steward it in a way that honors God. Okay? Have you heard any of these kind of ways of thinking about work? Maybe one or more of these are the way that you think about your work. And, you know, while there's some truth to actually each of these approaches, there's something to commend about each of them. I'm going to argue that on their own, they are actually woefully short of capturing a biblical understanding of what work is. In fact, it's a little odd that, you know, many Christians, they've heard thousands of sermons and read the Bible many times. They read Christian books, but they've never really thought biblically, thought carefully, theologically about their work. We spend more time at our job than almost anything else in our life, and yet many of us haven't really thought that deeply about its significance and how it fits into our faith in God and how those things work together. Our faith is over here and our work is over here, and neither the twain shall meet, sort of thing. So I want us to think Christianly about our work, whether it's your career or whether it's gardening and homemaking and volunteer work, whatever it is that you're working at. I want that in your mind as we talk about these and look at these passages, and that you should approach that work, whatever you're working at, biblically and carefully, thoughtfully. And while we often evaluate the goodness of work or the quality of work, its significance, through the lens of money, the Bible has a very different way of evaluating the goodness of work. And so we want to approach the thing that we do more than anything else through a biblical lens. Now, when it comes to our work, there's a really important word that we have either lost or sort of just misunderstood, and that's this word vocation, right? I don't quite hear it used as much as I think it used to be. And the word vocation comes from the Latin word vocare, which means to call. A vocation is not a job, it's a calling. And a job is a vocation, a calling, if someone has called you to it. There's a bigger purpose than just working for yourself. If you're just working for yourself, it's a job. If you're working because you have to, it's a job. But if someone has called you to it, there's a grander purpose, a divine calling behind it. Now it's a vocation, and now it has meaning and purpose and dignity. So what makes a job a vocation? When is it just work, and when is it a calling? Now, before the Reformation, there was this divide. God's work, secular work, and they were very separate. If you wanted to do God's work, you were a monk or a priest. They were doing God's work. That work is a calling. Everyone else was not. They were just working, and they should support those who are doing God's work. And it was this very distinct divide between God's work and common work. But with the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation changed radically the way we think about work and calling. Martin Luther argued that all work, even the so-called secular work, was as much a calling from God as the ministry of a monk or a priest. And the Lutheran tradition put a special emphasis on the dignity of all work, recognizing, think about this, that God providentially cares for, feeds, clothes, and supports the human race through human work, right? Like, if you think about it, how does God provide for us? Through human work. Most of the answers to our prayers are actually answered through humans working, working at their vocation. We pray for food on the table. We pray for health. We pray for education and safety and peace. And these prayers are answered by God commonly through the work of farmers, doctors, teachers, police officers, and so on. That God answers our prayers through people doing their job in many cases. And so all work has dignity and is a calling from God because God is sustaining us and answering our prayers, providing for the human race through people just working at their vocation. Then those in the more Reformed tradition, like Abraham Kuyper, later on emphasized that all work is God's calling as it directs and structures creation. So in this view, the purpose of work is the creating of a culture that honors God and helps people to thrive, human thriving and flourishing. And so these Protestant understandings of work really revolutionized not only theology but the world. You've heard the term the Protestant work ethic, right? This came out of this changing idea of what work really is that built into Protestant theology, originating with Luther, was this idea that whatever your vocation is, you are to work hard as if you're working for God and not just man. And in one sense, Canada and the U.S. have become great nations because they were founded on this theology of work. And the founding people that started these nations deeply were shaped by this view and theology of work, and that led to the greatness of our countries in many ways. So let's go back to the beginning and look at the Bible, look at how God has designed us for work. So this is, Genesis 1, let's read verse 27 28. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Let's skip ahead to chapter 2. This is verse 1 to 3. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. And then jump down to chapter 2, verse 15. Chapter 2 is sort of a zoomed-in retelling of chapter 1, kind of focuses in more on the details of creating of man. So in there, the way they put it there is chapter 2, verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it, okay? So the first thing we see from the story of Genesis is that that work is good. The first thing we see is that work is good, that when the Bible begins and God creates everything, one of the first things that we learn about that he talks about is work. We see that God works. That's really significant, that in God's creation of the world, it is called his work. And the creation of the world is actually portrayed as a prototypical work week. God works for 6 days, and then he rests for one day. And then our whole lives are patterned after God's work week. We work and rest and have a work week because God had a work week. It's built into the fabric of the world of this pattern of work and rest. And this is really significant that God works and rests, because this idea of creation and God's work is not shared by everyone by any means. In fact, in the ancient religions of Israel's ancient neighbors at the time of this writing, they all believed that the world came into being as a product of sort of conflict between varying gods, right? In the Babylonian creation story, the world was created when Marduk kills Tiamat and forges the world out of her dead carcass, right? So the earth is actually the dead carcass of a god, and it's built out of conflict. And so their creation myth shapes the way they view the world. And so because of their belief in how the world is created, they viewed the world as chaotic and unpredictable and birthed out of violence and death. And that shapes the way you view the world and the role of humans in the world. In ancient Greek religion, in the Golden Age, gods and the men walked together and nobody did any work because the earth just produced fruit and was flourishing and nobody did any work at all. And then later on, things got worse, because in Greek mythology, everything's better and it progressively gets worse in time. They have the opposite of life improvement. So later on, the gods left. They fled to Mount Olympus, and humanity had to work, and they had to work the earth to bring forth food and to feed the gods. The gods don't work. Humans work. And the humans work for the gods. And so that shaped the way they viewed life and work, that work is for the low and never the high. Likewise, if you believe that the world was not created by a designer who worked it, but instead the product of evolutionary processes, this too will shape how you view the world and humans' purpose in the world. So it's deeply significant and unique that when the Bible talks about creation, it talks about a God who works, who creates, and that this world is a product of a creator who worked and created with intentionality. God is a worker who does good work. His work is creative. He creates something out of nothing. He's the only one that creates something out of nothing. We call ourselves creators, but we always create out of something. His work is beautiful. His work is orderly and patterned. There's structure and design and purpose in his work. His work is not chaotic, but is very intentional. His work is good, very good. And so we see that God is a worker who does good work. And then, building off that, what we see is that God calls his created people to join in his work. You know that? We join in God's work. Work is not part of the fall, a necessary evil to fight against, but is actually part of creation. The fall affected work, which we're going to talk about in a bit, but it didn't invent work. Even before sin, humanity was called to work as God worked. God tells them to fill the earth and subdue it. The filling is obvious, right? It's a command to produce life, to have children, to fill the earth with humans. But subduing, we often ignore that part. What does that mean? The subduing has to do with cultivating human life and developing culture. The word subdue indicates that though God's work is good, it was actually undeveloped. It wasn't done. While all the building blocks were there in place, there was still work for humanity to do to subdue creation and to work with it to produce the perfect situation for human life. So when God created, he left it undeveloped to a degree for us to subdue. We join in his work. Here's what this means. Talking to my kids, and we're teaching them and just through the ordinary things of life. We say, you know, look at that mountain. Isn't it beautiful? God made that mountain. Look at the ocean. God made the ocean. Isn't it beautiful? And when they're young, they're still learning, right? Did God make this car? Did God make our house? They're trying to figure out what did God make. When you tell them God made some things, and then they're wondering, did God make everything? And so, what would you say? God make our house? Well, no, God didn't make our house exactly. I mean, people made our house out of wood and other things that God made. So we took things that God made and we made stuff out of what God made. So, you know, kind of, not really. So that's true, right? There's a difference between God's work and ours. God creates out of nothing, and we take things that God made and make them into other new things. We remake, right? And while God didn't make the house or the car, he did want us to. Do you see this? He wanted us to. He gave us the resources that we needed and the capacity to learn and subdue creation and create a world that suits human flourishing. So God gave us this mandate to subdue creation, and that means that we take what we find, the undeveloped created world, and build out of it and work it and learn and develop into a place for greater and greater human flourishing. So this means science is deeply biblical. Discovering medicine and surgery and nutrition and health and how the world and our bodies work. Engineering and how to use different materials to build safely and to live safely. We were fulfilling this subduing mandate as we invented airplanes and cured measles and learned about physiotherapy and invented ice cream. This is God's work. And this work is not running counter to God's work, but is actually fulfilling our mandate and joining in God's work. The earth is like a garden. We weren't meant to leave it alone, but to tend it and cultivate it and care for it and learn about it. And this extends beyond science and inventing into creating human society as well. Tim Keller, in his book on work, Every Good Endeavor, which is excellent, if you're interested in this, you should read it. He writes, God is mandating that humans will create culture. Adam and Eve will produce children. Those children will create families, and those families will band together into cities and social networks. Those networks of human beings will reflect all the aspects of human culture, language and art and food and philosophy and theology. See, the cultural mandate means that we are tasked to work at creating a healthy, flourishing human culture. We're fulfilling our mandate and joining God's work as we build a healthy, productive society, educating our children, cooking healthy and delicious food, cultivating arts and music and beauty, designing beautiful homes and communities for human flourishing, growing a healthy economy where people are able to work hard, be fruitful, and produce, teaching people to reason and to think and to do sound theology, policing, keeping everyone safe and free. This is God's work. This is what he wants us to do. And so God's work and our work are not disconnected. God has called us to work in his world, to cultivate and subdue the earth, to take what he has made and to make it flourish. We work with purpose and dignity when we join in God's work and his purposes and obey his mandate. So work is not evil. It has great dignity because God's not even above work. So neither are we. God was a gardener in the Old Testament and a carpenter in the New Testament. So even these vocations, which we often look down upon, have great dignity and value as our work connects to his work. So whenever we're bringing order out of chaos, cultivating life, subduing creation, we are acting like God, bearing his image, looking like him, and we are acting for God, fulfilling the mandate that he left for us. whenever we're using our skills and opportunities to work out of service to God and to others, we are fulfilling God's purposes in our work. Okay, but Steve, hang on. If work is so godly and dignified, how come it doesn't feel that way, right? I go to work and it's painful. It's not fun. I don't like my job. It's hard. It's hard. It doesn't feel as dignified and glorious as you're making it sound. And this is true. You know, if work is so good, how come we say TGIF and not TGIM, right? Like, why do we look forward to retirement as so attractive? Why does anyone retire if work is so great, right? And that's where we turn to Genesis 3. So flip over to Genesis 3. We're going to look at verse 17 to 19. And this is the verses where God is explaining the curses to Adam and Eve for their sin. So now sin has been introduced to the world, and this is what happens. Verse 17, chapter 3, verse 17. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and you've eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Okay, because of our sin, what we learn here, because of our sin, and because of the fall, our good work has become hard, painful, even futile. The fall makes work hard, makes it futile. The ground is cursed, and Adam's work becomes difficult and painful. The ground will now produce not only food, but thorns and thistles. Before Adam's sin, work was satisfying and fruitful, and it was easy to make life flourish. But now he's paddling upstream. The work is hard. Futility is introduced. Sometimes you'll work hard and have no results for it. Now the ground produces food and weeds, and the weeds grow faster. And Adam is going to eat now by the sweat of his brow. Work will be hard, and he will work the ground until the day he dies and becomes ground. The ground will win in the end. And eventually, he will join it. So there's this futility that is introduced because of sin with the fall. Do you ever feel like you're stuck in an endless cycle of work, right? You do laundry, and guess what? The next day, there's more. I mean, how many outfits do these kids wear every day, right? It doesn't end. You cook a meal, and you finally, you know, you clean up, everything's looking good, and then you get hungry, and you're like, I just did this. Now, it doesn't end. Didn't we just do this? You cut the grass, and the stupid stuff grows back, but never as fast as the weeds. It feels like we're just stuck in this futility of work. Whatever your job is, there's an element of futility. There's always more patience. There's always more broken cars and unhappy clients. There's always more coming, right? It never ends. There's futility and difficulty introduced into our work. Sometimes it's beautiful and glorious and satisfying and fun, and other times it just feels futile. Whatever work you do, there's an element of that. There's wonderful breakthroughs and huge setbacks and frustrations in our work. And so our work is good and dignified, honorable, but it's also hard. It's also hard. Now, understanding why work is hard is helpful, and I think there's a way to, I'd like us to bring the gospel into the futility of work. Let the futile and frustrating tasks of work remind you of the hope we have in Christ. See, when you see the dishes pile up again, or the weeds need to be pulled, or whatever it is that's futile in your work, be reminded that this cursed and broken world is not the end of the story for us. Be reminded that there will be a day when the futility of work is ended because Jesus bore the curse to set us free from sin, yes, but also from the curse of futile work. Smile as you scrub that pot and remember that God is redeeming all things, even dirty pots, through Jesus Christ. You know, Isaac Watts, I think, captured this beautifully in his hymn, "Joy to the World." "Joy to the World" was never intended to be a Christmas song. It's kind of, I don't think he would have been surprised that we sing it at Christmas, honestly, because it's not about Christ's first coming at Advent. It's about his second coming. He wrote the hymn to celebrate Christ's glorious and triumphant return, and its original title was "The Messiah's Coming and Kingdom." And in the third verse of "Joy to the World," the one that Mariah Carey and VeggieTales leave out, I don't know why. Well, I do know why. He writes of the reversing of the curse of work and the coming of Christ. Listen how he puts the end you know, Christ's return means the end of the curse of work. This is what he says. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. See, he understood that when Jesus comes, Jesus will redeem all things, even the futility of our work. No more thorns, no more thistles infesting the ground, but blessing instead, far as the curse. As far as the curse goes, the blessing of Christ's reign will go further and undo all that is broken, including pots that you just can't scrub and weeds that keep growing back. So, in a fallen and sinful world, people will work even with bad motives. So we have, you know, work is good, but we can bring bad motives to our work, contradicting then God's purposes for our work. So good work done with sinful motives. You know, some people work for self-glorification. You know, when their work is always meant to point to God and to honor God who created us for meaningful work and calls us into meaningful work, but instead we can manipulate it and use work to glorify ourselves. This is sinful and wrong. Some people work by exploiting others instead of serving others. So their work doesn't contribute to human flourishing, but is actually destructive. Their work causes greater pain. Some people work without integrity. They work as sinfully as they can. You know, they lie, they cheat, they deceive, they manipulate for their own gain. And this work does not honor God either, but actually causes greater destruction and goes against God's good purposes for our work. Some people's work, just the work itself, is inherently destructive. You know, the job that they're in is a destructive profession, and they should flee it. It destroys creation. It hurts human flourishing. It doesn't build culture, but tears it down. It doesn't cultivate those things. So not all work is good. Some work is actually inherently destructive. And so the curse has created a sinful kind of work. We can work in a way that is actually evil. So here we are. Okay, we're working various ways, home or at a job, whatever it may be. We're doing something. We're working at something. And we know that work is good, but it's hard because of sin. And we know that we can work in a way that fulfills the cultural mandate and joins in God's work, or we can work in a way that furthers the curse and works against God's work. So then how are we to work? How are we supposed to work in the in-between stage? Besides thinking about our work, how do we practically work in this in-between cursed yet good stage that we're in? Well, 1 Corinthians 10:31, we're told, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And this must include all the hours we spend at work as well. So how do we do work for the glory of God? How can we honor God in our vocation? Well, I'm thinking about this, and I have a number of ways for us to think about. Here we go. We honor God when we work to cultivate human flourishing. You know, when we work for the fruitfulness of the world and for the good of others. This honors God. Fruitful work that helps humanity to do better, to flourish. This is what God has called us to. We honor God when we work to please him and not just man. Paul says in Colossians 3, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. We honor God when we work wholeheartedly, motivated by pleasing God, acting as though he was our employer. Dorothy Sayers famously said, the church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him to not be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand of his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. He should make good tables. He should do his work well. Third, we honor God when we submit to authority. Submission honors God. Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:1, let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. So we are to honor those in authority over us. And if we don't, we actually risk reviling the name of God and the gospel. Our submission to authority reflects the glory of God and the gospel. And Paul said in Romans 13, pay to all what is owed to him, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. If Paul can pay taxes and honor the wicked Caesar, I'm pretty sure we can show honor to even the sinful authorities in our life and work. We honor God when we honor those who are in authority over us. Fourth, we honor God when we work without grumbling or complaining. Philippians 2, 14, 15, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. All things, do all things, would have to include all the time we spend at work. Our attitude in how we work can make us lights in the world or not. There's actually a lot at stake in our attitude and whether we grumble at work. Next, we honor God when we refuse to make our work and our money into idols that we worship and put above all other things. Jesus taught us in Matthew 6, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. See, there's a very real temptation to serve money and career in place of God. But God will not share our worship. We honor God when we refuse to idolize our career and wealth. We work at it, we value it, we pursue it, we do our best, but we will not place it in the supreme position. We recognize its place and its boundaries. It is noble and good. It is not God. That's an important distinction. We honor God when we recognize that our work is not God. It is good, but it is not God. We honor God when we don't trust in our wealth for security, but instead trust God. And so we are able to live simply and generously. 1 Timothy 6, 17 to 19. Paul says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them to not be haughty nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. God is glorified in it as his people refuse to place their hope in believing in the security of money and jobs, which he calls uncertain. When we don't trust the uncertainty of money and instead trust him, and trusting him for all things, are able to live generously and simply. We honor God when we live that way, when we don't make our job our ultimate security, but we recognize God is our security. We honor God when we recognize that God is building our character and his work of sanctification in us through the joys and challenges of work. Right? God does not just work in us on Sundays or in our quiet time or in our community group, but he is molding us and making us, shaping us into the image of Christ through the trials and opportunities of our workplace. We spend more time than anywhere else, almost, at our work. And in fact, we face more of our challenges, for many of us, at our work. So would God not be interested in shaping us and changing us and growing us in that place? And so we honor God as we approach our workday, asking, how are you shaping me more into the image of Jesus today through the joys and challenges of this day at my work? That he is sanctifying us through our work. We honor God when we rest from our labors, believing that the world will be just fine without us. There's a call to work hard. There's a call to rest. By working hard and then ceasing from our labors to rest in God, we honor him and show that we really do understand that he is God and I am not. I can rest because I'm not God. That seems obvious. I know you don't hesitate for a second in believing that I am God. And yet, that is why we cannot rest, is we have a God complex. If you never rest, it's probably because you haven't figured out, made this distinction and learned that I'm not God. The world does not need me. I can stop. I can rest. This is especially difficult if you have the type of job that seems to never end. If you've got a shift and it ends and you can go home and rest, that's simpler. But if you run your own business, you know, if you're a homemaker, any sort of job where there's always more to do and it's depending on you and it doesn't start and end, you don't clock in, there's always more to be done. If you have that type of job, you particularly need to obey the instruction to stop and rest, even when the work isn't done. And in doing so, you honor God and demonstrate that you truly believe that he is God. He's got it under control. I don't always have to work. I can obey and I can rest because I'm not God. There's this temptation around work to build our identity through our work. This is who I am. I am what I do. We define ourselves by what we do and how much we make. When we think about ourselves, we think about ourselves as a worker who does a certain job, certain vocation. You know, and we bring with it the constructs of our society and the assumptions of our society. You know, white-collar jobs are better than blue-collar jobs, and both are better than service jobs. Nobody wants to be, you know, a lot of people view themselves as too good to be in the service industry. High-paying jobs are better than lower-paying jobs because the amount of money earned is the greatest factor in deciding what is an important job and what's not important, and determining the value of a job instead of what it provides for society and for the good that it cultivates. So we find our self-worth in our careers, what we do, how much we make, how far up the ladder we can go. And this view leads us to esteem certain jobs and despise others simply because of the education required or the income generated. And I'm telling you, this is backwards. The Bible calls us to something different. So there's this great temptation to build our identity on proving our worth and earning lots of money. But the gospel changes this. A Christian who really understands the gospel will look at work quite differently. Tim Keller puts it this way. The gospel frees us from the relentless pressure of having to prove ourselves and to secure our identity through work. For we are already proven and secure. It also frees us from the condescending attitude towards less sophisticated labor and from envy over more exalted work. All work now becomes a way to love God, love the God who saved us freely, and by extension, a way to love our neighbor. See, the gospel changes the way we look at work, changes the way we measure good work and bad work, changes the way the work that we value and the work that we aspire to. As we know and believe the gospel, we are set free from the idolatry and slavery of work and are called into the joy of godly vocation. I think of two great men and the opposite ways that God used them. I've referenced these men before, but it's relevant to our topic at hand. And I've read excellent biographies on both recently, and they're both well worth learning about. And the first is John Newton. And if you're interested, I'd recommend the book by Jonathan Aitken on John Newton, From Disgrace to Amazing Grace. And the second man is William Wilberforce. And you'll want to read Eric Metaxas' biography, Amazing Grace. It's phenomenal. And these two men, God worked powerfully through these two men in the same time. They were friends. John Newton was much older, but they were friends. But he worked through them in opposite ways. It's fascinating. John Newton, many know his story, was a very successful and fairly wicked sea captain of a slave trading vessel for many years. But after his conversion, he stayed a sea captain for a little bit, but then he left that job. He didn't stay as a sea captain in a slave trading or otherwise. He became kind of the equivalent of now maybe a port master. He kind of oversaw the whole port and coming in and out of his city. And it was a very well-paying job, a very honorable job that was actually hard to get. But he felt this burning calling to become a pastor. And he studied for years. He attempted the ordination exam many times and kept failing it before finally, after many years, he got approved and became ordained as a Church of England pastor. And he pastored a small-town church that was not that remarkable for many years. But he wrote a powerful autobiography of his conversion. And he went on to write publish a book of hymns called Only Hymns, which included in that book of hymns was the most famous song ever written, Amazing Grace. And his biography estimated that song is sung 10 million times a year. And so he followed God's calling on his life from the sea to small town preacher, from the sea to the pulpit. When William Wilberforce met Jesus, he was a young and influential politician in England. He had political and social connections. He was born into the right family, the right class. He had tremendous gifts, and he had a tremendous and blossoming political career. He was in his early 20s and was a rising star in politics in England. But upon his conversion at that time, he was rocked by the gospel, and he just felt that perhaps he should leave politics, become a pastor. He thought his gifts might be better used in pastoral work. And he visited his old friend John Newton. He was a family friend. And at this point, he was kind of nearing the end of his life. And Newton actually discouraged Wilberforce from leaving politics and becoming a pastor. Don't do it, he said. He encouraged Wilberforce to stay where he was and use the gifts that God had given him for God's service in politics. So Wilberforce stayed, and he sought to serve God and honor him in his vocation. And he wrestled with this and prayed about this. What do I do? How do I honor you? And Wilberforce came to see God's calling on his vocation, and he famously put it this way, and he repeated this many times in his life, but he famously wrote, "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." By manners, he means like moral reform. And so he viewed it that God had called him to these two things. This is the two things he's going to spend his life in politics doing. He's committed his life to ending the slave trade and to moral reform in England. And for 18 years, he worked tirelessly to have the slave trade abolished. 18 straight years, he brought the bill to Parliament and had it rejected for 17 years until it finally passed, and he devoted his life to it. 26 years after that, slavery was abolished altogether throughout the British Empire, including Canada, and Wilberforce heard news of this victory on his deathbed and just died just 2 days later, satisfied knowing that he had accomplished his calling, his vocation. And these two men, John Newton and William Wilberforce, had a tremendous impact on the world. They changed the world in radical ways. And their faith in Jesus Christ totally changed them inside and out. They were never the same. They changed the way they looked at everything. They changed the way they worked. And for Newton, following Jesus meant leaving his successful career to become a small town pastor, largely unknown until after his death. Really, Amazing Grace was not known until years later. And for Wilberforce, following Jesus meant staying in his career, but looking at it really differently. His career was there, no longer there to serve him and glorify him, but was an opportunity to serve Jesus. See, God may call you to be a pastor or a missionary. He may call you to be a homemaker. He may call you to be in business or politics or policing or teaching or any number of things. But whatever he calls us to serve him there. And our vocation is primarily about serving Jesus and joining in God's work. And when we do that, it is a noble and beautiful and glorious thing. Let's pray together.